I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In the famously musical state of Oklahoma, these were public school music teachers in a victory march around their state capital this week. How impossible was it, you ask, for those teachers to win walkouts in two tax-cutting Trump red states, West Virginia, where the teachers just got a 5% raise, and in Oklahoma, where they want more? Teachers' salaries in Oklahoma start at $32,000, lowest anywhere but Mississippi. Over a decade, spending on schools has been reduced more than a quarter. It takes a supermajority, three-quarters of that legislature, to raise taxes. But this week, strange to tell, masses of Oklahoma teachers went to the State House instead of their schools and won $6,000 raises for themselves and a very substantial tax increase passed the legislature under the personal glare of Harold Hamm, Oklahoma's richest oil man, who almost became Donald Trump's energy secretary. The next tests of the teachers' turn to payroll politics will come in Kentucky, then Arizona, and several impressions of a changing political order will be tested, too. First, the teachers could be the model of an emerging activist, white-collar working class. Also, that the glory days almost a century ago of striking miners and dissident labor are not forgotten or gone. The teachers we got to talk with were making the most of missing their classrooms.
We're literally walking through either the House or the Senate gallery.
Didn't they tell you that the oil companies owned it, the Capitol?
Yes, and I know they are here also lobbying for themselves, but we are here in the thousands.
We just had this breaking point. And, I think it could have occurred a year ago. It could have occurred a year from now. It just, somebody said, let's walk out, and people jumped on board.
Unfortunately, our claim to fame here in Oklahoma is that we're leading the U.S. in education cuts. We have to have supplies. We have to have technology. We have to have more teacher allocations. A lot of our smaller districts in Oklahoma have gone to a four-day school week. Because they don't have the funding. Yeah, it's heartbreaking.
I don't want to have to be rationed paper. I want to have the maps I need to teach European history and to teach world history. I don't want to have to worry about whether I can supply my students with colored pencils to do projects or just regular pencils to write their notes.
I don't have enough books for kids. Books are falling apart. Kids can't check out textbooks. We just don't have enough of them.
Teachers will stand up for themselves. If other state legislatures continue to defund public ed, the teachers are going to get angry. They're going to show up, and they're going to demand that their children, their kids, are taken care of.
Reagan Kalaki teaches high school English in Edmond, outside Oklahoma City. He said the zeal of a young teacher gets tested in Oklahoma.
If you're a teacher in Oklahoma, then you're a teacher that has to piece together a living, meaning you have to have second jobs. And so for me, I work for the National Math and Science Initiative, and I do workshops for students on the weekends around the country. And I also have my own pool cleaning business, and that's another way to bring in revenue during the summer. But that's not really the reason why this walkout is still happening. We're all down here walking and marching because of a lack of funding in education in Oklahoma. They passed an actual bill to increase our salaries significantly, not to the extent of what we were asking originally, but they did pass one. And so with the passage of that bill, we will eventually get a raise. But the problem is like increasing revenue resources.
They gave you six on a demand for $10,000 a year. What's next?
Yes, sir. Next is to actually like fully fund the budget. And we have basically around three different things that we're wanting. A cost of living adjustment for retirees, an increase in a stipend with our support staff, which is not nearly enough. And the third is public employees additionally have not received a raise as well. But the problem is that our House of Representatives, have to get the bill out of committee and actually have to vote on it, debate it, and vote on it here in the next few days. Or we'll be down here every single day. And then what's interesting about this movement is it started with a 24-year-old kid teaching history in Stillwater, Oklahoma, and he starts a Facebook page after West Virginia, and now here we are.
Every teacher in the state, like, is a part of this group now. Oklahoma Teacher Walkout Now is the name of the group.
So what's inspiring about this is that it is a grassroots movement, and it's getting stronger every single day. This is the biggest day so far, and we got to keep the pressure on our legislature to actually do their job. And they're going to be scare tactics. There's going to be different things they're going to do to try and keep us from coming up here. You're going to have parents that are going to be angry. Snow days are going to be used up. Once our snow days are used up, we're going to have to make up those days at the end of the year. And so we're going to see parents upset. We're going to see their vacation plans go through. We're going to see a variety of different, like, public backlash. We can anticipate that. But in the face of public backlash, we're still going to have to stay strong. We're still going to have to stay united. And we're still going to have to do what's best for the kids.
Dana Goldstein wrote a solid 100-year history of the teacher wars and our most embattled profession before she got the education assignment at the New York Times. She reported the Oklahoma story this week under the Times headline, "It Really Is a Wildfire."
I think what we're seeing now is significant in a new way, because after the West Virginia teachers last month did a really daring wildcat type of strike, from the grassroots up, surprising their union leaders with the strength of their fury, really, you know, they did win a race from their legislature and all these other red states, Oklahoma, perhaps Kentucky, perhaps Arizona, looked at West Virginia and said, hey, we're also living in this austerity climate. Our school budgets have been cut to the bone. Our salaries sometimes qualify us for food stamps, our children for Medicaid and Head Start. Something has got to give here, and they were so inspired by the example in West Virginia that they have taken to the streets around these state capitals, and that's what we're beginning to see.
In overrunning a legislature that we think of as being owned and operated by the oil industry, with Harold Hamm, of all people, in the gallery glaring at the legislators, they forced a tax increase through that legislature.
They did. And I think it really is extraordinary. And I was on the phone with a representative of the Oil and Gas Association there in Oklahoma. And what happened is that the production taxes on the wells was raised. And this is an industry that's used to getting its way in this state. They're really surprised. So the teachers really did make this happen with this protest movement. It would not have happened otherwise.
So many things are changing here, including just the general picture that the teachers are the good guys suddenly. They were not entirely in Chicago or in New York back in the 60s.
Right. I think that's right. I mean, if you look back at the Obama era for education reform, it was really about a sort of technocratic education reform agenda, which entailed giving kids more standardized tests so that those test scores could then be used to evaluate teachers, potentially to fire ineffective teachers. And teachers were not huge fans of this agenda. Their unions resisted this agenda. But the public wasn't quite sure what to make of that dispute. It was a bit technical and complicated to get into. And so we didn't see a real mass movement.
Let's get back to basics. Spelled money is the fascinating thing to me. There's been so much talk about charter reforms or curriculum reforms, testing for success, excellent by individual kids or school composite scores, that sort of thing. And suddenly, it's very basic. No, we're pretending to do magic, cutting budgets and playing with the system. How about just paying people more, making it a much more attractive, happier profession?
You're right. And teachers are saying, you know, I can't be expected to raise student achievement, to close gaps between low-income kids and middle-class kids. I can't be expected to do any of that when I have to go home at the end of the day and work a second job as an Uber driver. You know, I don't have the time to commit to my vocation, my true passion, teaching, when I have to work overtime just to make ends meet. What's been really interesting to me talking to teachers in West Virginia and Oklahoma the past couple of weeks is that they're describing themselves as working class. Now, in my book, you know, I go back to the 19th century, and at that time, teachers really did think of themselves as working class. But after teachers won collective bargaining in this country in the 60s, they really stopped thinking of themselves so much as working class. Their conditions improved a lot. They started thinking themselves really as sort of unionized white-collar, middle-class, upper-middle-class professionals, especially as more and more teachers went out to earn graduate degrees. So they're really a highly educated group. So the fact that these folks are saying, I'm part of the working class and this is a working-class movement, that really is striking to me. I think it reflects the fact that teachers don't necessarily feel treated as professionals. There's so much that goes into that, whether it's state legislatures that are trying to make it so that it's much easier to become a teacher so you don't need specialized training. Teachers are, you know, angry sometimes that they don't get a lot of breaks to use the bathroom during the day that they're at work. They feel infantilized by those types of rules. So there's so much swirling around in this movement. And I think it's really interesting that so many of these young millennial teachers in their early 20s are driving this. They're the ones who got on Facebook. They're the ones that started these Facebook groups to push for a walkout. And now the unions are listening to them and saying, you've asked to push further, faster, you're angry. We want to support you in that. But it really is those young people who drove this.
Dana Goldstein, write a 2018 epilogue to your 100-year survey of teachers' wars in this country.
A lot has changed. You know, I think this is a wake-up call for education reformers, those people who've been focused on stuff like charter schools and teacher evaluation and tenure for teachers, depicting tenure as the great evil that causes kids to do badly in school. You know, I think this is a wake-up call. You know, how can we talk about those things until we first fix the basics, which is teachers should have a living wage. You know, they should be able to repay their college and graduate school loans and provide for their families. And then schools need to have stuff like textbooks. You know, it's pretty basic. In Oklahoma, there's a number of districts in rural areas that have four-day school weeks. So you can imagine the just insanity that that causes for parents trying to figure out what to do with young children on that fifth day. So it is a back-to-basics conversation in terms of education policy right now.
That was Dana Goldstein of the New York Times. Coming up, Bernie Sanders, millennials, and his mindset driving the news in Trump territory. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about the teacher strikes. Our guest, Jennifer Berkshire, makes her living, almost, as she says, writing, editing, and causing trouble in her blog coverage and her podcasting about education in general. Check her work at haveyouheardblog.com. Jennifer, nobody wrote about the teachers' uprising in West Virginia with a keener sense, I think, of something big breaking. And then Oklahoma, Kentucky's next. What is happening? Big picture.
Well, I think it is such an amazing story, and I would really encourage people to look at what's happening in Arizona as well, where you have these two different trends. You have the teachers rising up in just the way that Dana described, where you have young teachers in this driving this Red for Ed movement, saying, you know, we will not tolerate this bottom of the barrel funding level for our schools, and we deserve to be paid more. But then you have this other movement from the right, which is to really to go towards a sort of radical education system that's essentially liberated from brick and mortar schools, what I think of as edu-debit cards. And so you see these two movements now sort of clashing. And so I would really encourage people to watch. I think that Arizona hasn't gotten enough attention and that there is a grassroots movement there that's going to show us that this isn't just about teachers per se. It's about the future of public education and whether what states are obligated to provide.
Dana Goldstein was just saying that there's a wake-up call here for the reformers in the Obama manner. There's a wake-up call for austerity, I think. There's a wake-up call, a variety of kinds, about the union movement. What are you betting?
Well, the wake-up call on austerity is so, you're so right about that, that if these guys come into office and they pledge that we're never going to raise taxes, that is all, that's a recipe for underfunded schools, right? And so the other thing you're saying is that, and I think people are missing this part of the story, that these uprisings are happening in states where there's really been an erosion of democracy, right? That one of the little tidbits from West Virginia that I thought was so telling was that people commented that in the days prior to the strike by the teachers, no one had seen the governor around the state house. That
really?
That there's really no need for these guys to even show up because the policies are all being dictated by the corporate lobby, right? So in Oklahoma, it's oil and gas. In West Virginia, it's coal. It's all Alec. It's the Koch brothers. And so Oklahoma's inability to raise taxes without a supermajority is an example of that.
That's exactly something I wanted you to run past you. You're an independent writer, Jennifer, with an admitted tilt in favor of public schools and an open suspicion of these market-driven alternatives. In this whole, all the news this week, what jumps out to my ear is the undeclared bias in what the so-called authority figures are saying about the teachers. The governor of Oklahoma, Mary Fallon, for example, about teachers wanting salary raises, she said, "It's kind of like having a teenage kid that wants a better car." So much for teachers as grown-ups with real bills to pay. But listen to this. A promotional video for Governor Fallon made for the Heritage Foundation. And it sounds to me like a full catalog of buzzwords and put-downs aimed at the schools we've always known.
We all know that children learn differently, that you can't have a one-size-fits-all education system for every particular child's need, but having an education savings account gives parents and gives students an opportunity to look at what's the best education for them and where to go. I don't think it's radical for any parent or any student to want to get the very best education wherever that best fits the student's needs. If you're in a very poor area and maybe you don't have the best school and there's challenges within that school system, in whatever state you live in or whatever city you live in, this is especially a way for people that may not be able to send their kids to private school to be able to send them to a different school. If we can get our foot in the door and be able to give our students and their parents an opportunity to have choices and give quality education to our children in whatever form's best for them, I think that's a good step forward.
Jennifer Berkshire, who wrote that script? It's all about getting rid of brick-and-mortar schools and sending the money back to rich people.
That, you know, there was such a flap earlier this week about on-air talent at the Sinclair Network reading the same script about fake news and threats to democracy. And you could do something very similar with the statement that she just made. Like, I could line up commissioners and advocates for this approach, and you would be really creeped out at how they use this, you know, these identical talking points that sound so innocuous, right? But then when you really start to poke and pry, what she's talking about is basically a prepaid EduDebit card where a percentage of a state's per pupil funding could then be accessed by the parent. In Arizona, Bank of America has the contract. And then the parent gets to decide, like, oh, it could go to a school. It could go be a down payment for a private school tuition. It could be for homeschooling supplies. It could be for tutoring. And it would be this radical tilt away from schools, especially schools and their democratic oversight, from the teachers who work in those schools and their awful, awful unions that represent them. Mm. And instead, you would have this sort of unbundled system, sort of like the way that we're unbundling our viewing choices from the cable company.
Stand by for John Shelton. John Shelton taught middle school kids in Boston before he got his doctorate and then a job teaching democracy and justice studies at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. Teacher Strike was his book last year on 100 years of such things. John Shelton, what feels so different about 2018 and the teachers?
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, John.
What's different about it? Well, I think what's been happening in West Virginia and Oklahoma, and Jennifer is spot on when you should be paying more to what's happening in Arizona too. What's different or what's happening is the fruit of long simmering tensions. So in these red states, there's been systematic disinvestment in public education, and you know what investment there has been, has been pushed towards school choice initiatives, as you alluded to, and I think in general, really in the last 30 years or so since the growing sense that education is really so vital for economic opportunity, and I have some problems with that notion, but we can come back to that. There's been this consensus that teachers needed to be sort of have their feet held to the fire and you know, be disciplined and ensure that they were keeping students accountable and you know, through standardized tests. And I think there's been these simmering tensions. And you know, as a historian, I'm always really attuned to contingency. And so there's been some great reporting about the early organizing in West Virginia by Sarah Jaffe and Michelle Chen in the Belabored podcast, where they pointed out that it actually started in these three school districts, three counties that really had this longstanding sense of labor history going back to the coal wars in the 1920s.
Right.
And then it spread from there across the state. And I don't think we would be talking about this right now if those teachers in West Virginia hadn't won. It's really important that they won. It was against the law when they went on strike, but they won. And that showed all of these teachers who were in other similar situations, like in Oklahoma and Arizona, that it really showed them the power that they had if they did something on the scale that happened in West Virginia.
John Chilton, let me just say, you wrote in the Washington Post yesterday that teachers in general are in a much stronger position looking forward, maybe even than they realized. They cannot be outsourced. There's no trade deal that can take them out of the game, nor digital technology can render them obsolete. Is this fundamentally different, do you think, from many famous teacher strikes, Chicago, New York, Boston, over many, many years? What's new here?
Yeah, so there's a couple things that are new. I mean, I write about what I call the era of teacher strikes in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And these were, you know, these were conflicts that were largely centralized in school districts, many of them urban, not all of them urban. But they were centralized in very specific metropolitan areas for the most part. And the fact that we're seeing something on this scale across an entire state is really, really unique. I mean, I think in part, you know, millennials are playing a big part of this, as we've already heard. But stuff like Facebook and really new organizing opportunities have played some part in this. But it is, I think, accurate to say that this is really the grassroots that are out in front of this. And I don't want to intimate that rank and file teachers in the 60s, 70s, and 80s didn't, you know, support the actions that were being taken by unions. But by and large, those were led by, you know, union leaders with, you know, in dialogue with rank and file teachers. I mean, these are really coming up from below. They're coming up in places where, you know, it's quite possible that in West Virginia and Oklahoma, many of the teachers that are leading this, they may not actually even be union members, or they may be now, but they might not have been when the strike started. And so it really is coming up from below. And that, to me, has been really the most interesting part about this. I mean, you played the Oklahoma band, the band playing the Twisted Sister song. I mean, if you can't be moved by that when you hear that, your heart isn't beating. That may be the most important music to come from Oklahoma since, you know, Woody Guthrie or something. I mean, it's really moving stuff.
I want to ask Jennifer Berkshire and you, John, why didn't we know until now that the underfunding, the slashing of educational budgets has persisted so long after the 08 recession deficits were restored? I mean, the government is not hurting for tax income anymore, and yet the cuts in the educational budgets are still striking.
I'll answer the first part of that, and then John can jump in. Dana Goldstein told you that this was really a wake-up call for education reformers, and part of their argument was that money really didn't matter. It was what you did with the money, and that you didn't really need these teachers who hung around forever, you know, and sapped up the salary schedule. You needed fresh new teachers, and that was really, you know, you were going to bring in Teach for America, and the idea was that you would get a teacher from Yale, and they would believe in the students. And that's what was going to do it, and that the thing that I think where the Arnie Duncans and the Democratic reformers really did so much damage was that they started bandying around the idea of adult interests versus kids' interests.
Meaning what?
Meaning that it was inappropriate for teachers to talk about their working conditions and that demanding money meant you were selfish.
Beneath them professionally, you mean?
Exactly, exactly. That you were, you know, you're, as a teacher, you were really, it was a kind of a missionary job, right? And so whenever teachers would start talking about their working conditions, they would be dismissed for putting adult interests first. And what you're seeing so vividly in states like West Virginia and now Oklahoma and then on to these others is that you can't separate, you know, when you've got 40 kids in a class with 30 chairs, it's preposterous to dismiss the teacher who's advocating for more money as somehow being driven by selfishness and not being single-mindedly focused on achievement.
Can I say, there are a lot of good ideas in school reform, even in charter schools, I would say. But overall, and in the long term, it seems to me Arnie Duncan and all of those bright ideas are going to look like a fig leaf on just plain defunding public education.
Well, I thought...
Is that going too far? Or?
I thought it was really strange that at the beginning of this week, Arnie Duncan had an op-ed in the Washington Post where he basically argued, you know, a lot of people are saying now that
right.
education reform...
Kids are doing
reform,
better than ever.
Or education reform didn't work. That's not true. And I thought, well, what a missed opportunity. Why wouldn't you, as the kind of Democratic spokesman for education, why wouldn't you take this opportunity to go out and really make a ringing cry on behalf of public school funding and investment as people, you know, like all everyone's tuned in watching what's happening in Oklahoma. I saw that as a big missed opportunity and a sign of what a small vision they're still attached to.
John Shelton, is there a wake up call here for about the defunding, the Betsy DeVos program, so to speak?
Yeah, I think there absolutely is. And, you know, I think to answer the question about, you know, why didn't we know about this? I think we did know about this, particularly in red states. You know, there's been an ideology, frankly, of, you know, for 30, 40 years now, that the way that political economy should work in this country is by cutting taxes and ensuring that corporations, the so-called job creators, can accumulate profits. And I don't think, frankly, that's ever been something that has appealed to the majority of Americans. I think Americans have generally accepted it because they've been told, really, you know, if you want to look for any sort of bipartisan consensus in the last 30 or 40 mm-hmm. years, it's been largely around this idea that we have to, you know, basically kind of further corporate interests in order to ensure that people have jobs. Mm-hmm. And so I think the majority of Americans in many places have accepted this because they felt like it would bring economic prosperity. But the last 10 years have really given the lie to that notion. I mean, we supposedly have full employment right now. Average workers have not seen their salaries keep up with it. They're not getting wage increases, even though they should be if we've got a really tight job market. But corporate profits are through the roof. And, you know, you combine that with the fact that we have these education systems in red states that, frankly, are crumbling. And I think...
The question is whether people have caught up with the news. John, you're in Wisconsin, where yeah. Governor Scott Walker made his reputation busting the teachers' union and other public unions. Is he going to pay for that now?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we have some very specific electoral politics here. He's running for a third term this November. There are some concerning things. We have a huge field of Democratic contenders and a very late primary. So I'm not sure, but I will say that Scott Walker and the Republican-held legislature in my home state have cut a tremendous amount of money, both from the K-12 and the higher ed system. And it's kind of telling that in Walker's last budget, he actually did provide a small per pupil wage increase across the state, in addition to a pittance of increased funding for the university system. And I think it shows that people in Wisconsin are starting to pay attention to that. And it's not an accident that his probably his biggest challenger, the candidate who's more than likely the front runner for the candidate, is our elected state superintendent of education named Tony Evers, who's a very popular politician. And I think it shows that Wisconsinites value education and are concerned about, you know, what's happened to this state through disinvestment.
Jennifer Berkshire, you note that Arne Duncan didn't leap up to promote the public system. Neither did his old boss Barack Obama exactly. Is there a Democrat out there who's ready to make this a cause, do you think?
I think the candidates who have their fingers in the wind are starting to make a shift. Every time one of these surprise election victories happens, where a Democrat wins a special election seat, I rush to their websites to see if they made public education an issue. and inevitably, it's up near the very top, because this is such an issue. You know, if you're in a state where deep cuts have been made, you've got Republicans and Democrats in those schools. Education is really a purple issue. What a, you know, a place to pick off Trump voters.
Who would be a candidate to your taste to carry this banner?
Well, I was really interested to see that one of the candidates for governor in Colorado, who I thought of as a real sort of reform guy, I went and looked at what he was saying, and he's really running now on public school funding, on pre-K, and he doesn't mention charter schools in his mission statement once. And
What's his name? That's
Jared Polis. But I think we are
nice name
still,
for a politician.
Isn't it? We are really waiting. Right now, the big problem is that there is a huge gap between the Democratic Party donors and influencers and the base. And we need the politicians to come around and side with the base on this.
We haven't even talked yet about the working class issue, the iconography of teachers, sometimes in their professional role, now in their sort of fighting street political role, but we'll get to it. We're talking about the teacher strikes. Coming up, the message in the teachers' red bandanas. That's part of the story. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about the teacher strikes. The last time we spoke with the labor historian Steve Fraser, it was about his book 3 years ago on the age of acquiescence, how American workers gave up their century of resistance to the power of organized money. Today, Steve Fraser is shocked and relieved to say that the acquiescence may be history. His new book is titled Class Matters.
When I teach, I tell my students there are at least two great mysteries in history. One is why people put up with what they put up with for as long as they put up with it. The other question is, why do they ever rebel against it? Because it's so dangerous to do so and rebel on behalf of their fellow workers. Well, in West Virginia, there's no question that part of the answer is that they identify with a long tradition rooted in the coal fields of West Virginia.
Yeah, these red bandanas tell you something, right?
Yes, they absolutely do. There's a long, noble, heroic tradition of fighting against the coal barons in coal mining country in places like West Virginia and Kentucky. And you know what? Oklahoma, this would probably not be known by many of your listeners, also has a long populist history, a history of militant labor movement organizing around the turn of the 20th century, again in the 1930s. It had actually a vigorous industrial workers of the world, what are sometimes known as the Wobblies movement. Also in Oklahoma, even before it became a state in 1891, there was a strong populist current in Oklahoma politics. So people think of these states as dyed-in-the-wool, conservative, acquiescent, and so on. But look, Arizona, it's Barry Goldwater country. It's one of the first right-to-work law states. I think it was passed in 1947, making it very difficult to unionize. Even Arizona has a long tradition of very militant labor movement action in the metalworking industry, in the hard metals, in copper mining, in silver mining. One of the most notorious events in all of American labor history happened in 1917 in Bisbee, Arizona, when the copper miners went on strike and the local constabulary in cahoots with Phelps Dodge deported, trucked them out in fetid cattle cars out into the desert, these strikes strikers, this was vigilante justice, and deposited them in the middle of the desert to break the strike in Bisbee, Arizona. Even as late as the 80s, there were militant mine strikes in places like Arizona. People don't entirely forget this. In West Virginia, the strikers, the teachers, were very conscious that they came from families that had lived through those labor wars in earlier periods of time. So that's part of the explanation. I think the other explanation is at a certain point, people say enough is enough. Why that point happens when it does, not entirely clear. It starts somewhere and then it spreads like wildfire, which is what used to happen quite commonly in American labor relations for a long century or more, beginning in the late 19th century, continuing through the New Deal and the Great Depression. It was very common.
Let's scrutinize this shift in the language, too. Teachers are suddenly good guys again and good people. They have regained moral authority in this argument that they didn't have in Chicago, for example.
Exactly,
just
yeah,
a few
right.
years ago. How does this happen? And how do we beware of the sort of, propaganda in our media? Suddenly, the teachers are being cast, and we like it, as emergent heroes, not just the old doormat.
You know, maybe partly the reason is that working people for the last decades now have been the invisibles in America, the looked past, the kind of unfashionable. I think one of the reasons this thing may be happening in unlikely states is that this is in some way that white, pardon the expression, working class, voicing its resentment about being overlooked for a long time by the bipartisan elites that have been running the country for a very long time, and whether that's Clinton or the Bushes or now our good friend the Donald.
Can I try another theory on you?
Yes, go ahead.
That part of the new sympathy for these teachers turns on a general middle-class anxiety about a shaky post-industrial digital economy in which all knowledge workers are feeling a lot more nervous than they did even a year ago, much less 5 years ago.
I think you're exactly right. In my book, The Age of Acquiescence, I talk a great deal about the emergence and development of precarious labor of all kinds, not just shape-ups of landscape workers to undocumented immigrants from Mexico, but how it infects all kinds, all regions of the economy, so that the kinds of things normal middle-class, working-class people used to take for granted, like job security, like pensions, like health care, like vacations.
Like a living wage.
Long since went by the boards. The labor movement and working people generally, their standards of living, I mean, even while there's been this enormous growth in wealth in the upper reaches of the American economy, working class America has basically stagnated or done worse than that, is downwardly mobile. Deindustrialization added a whole vast element of insecurity to the lives of people who had once enjoyed good paying union jobs with a lot of protections on the job, guarantees that they would be treated like human and not like dirt, all kinds of fringe benefits. Those days are gone for millions of people. They live in the ghost town, opioid-ridden remains of those places today. So I think there is a lot of sympathy. I think people feel that the teachers are another element of our society that is facing that kind of that struggle to survive.
That was Steve Fraser. His new book is Class Matters, subtitled The Strange Career of an American Delusion. John Shelton at the University of Wisconsin in Green Bay. Speak about the suggestion that we're casting teachers going forward as the forward edge of a workers' movement.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting idea. I'm a big admirer of Steve Fraser's stuff. We've talked about teachers as part of this, movement to protect and save public education, but I think it is an interesting question to ask whether or not they might be the kind of front lines of a new workers' movement. And I couldn't agree with Steve more that we have this middle class anxiety. And to me, what I think has been missing really from the politics of both parties has been a push to really make a different argument about how political economy works in this country. So you mentioned Harold Hamm, right, who could kind of stand in for the coal barons in West Virginia,
right.
You know, back in the 1920s. And, you know, to me, what's so powerful about what the teachers in Oklahoma are doing now, they've gotten a raise. It may not have been exactly what they wanted, but now they're saying we need to tax things specifically that are really things that the wealthy benefit from, right? They're proposing, they want a capital gains tax. They want to make things more, to go back to something Jennifer was saying earlier, and I think very smartly, to go back to a more democratic notion of a political economy, right? And as we've seen this growing anxiety, you could imagine why there would be that push for it. And I think it's quite possible that teachers could be on the front lines of that.
I liked Jedediah Purdy's line about his own native West Virginia, that the teachers are reclaiming the identity of the working class. In coal country, as he says, the old carbon capital of the industrial age, those teachers are making a sort of microcosm of the coming fights over who owns and profits from the finer, cleaner capital of mechanized production and digital platforms. It's a fight for all of us, in short. Jennifer?
Well, to me, one of the great ironies of this whole situation is that the reason that teachers came to be so demonized during the Obama era is that education was even more at the center of their economic platform than it had been under Clinton, right? This was basically all they had. And so when you think about what happened after Obama came into office, you know, any idea of making it easier for workers to unionize, that died a painful death. You know, Wall Street basically got off the hook. But they managed to work through state after state these incredibly complex policy changes where teachers were held accountable to student test scores. And the whole reason that they did that, you know, they really started talking about it in terms of global economic competitiveness.
Right.
And the idea that one, that would sort of fall by the wayside as a talking point, but two, that teachers would then, you know, who've been sort of mocked and demonized, would then sort of emerge as, you know, being as tapping into the anxiety that so many of us feel about the gig future, just to me, you know, exposes what a dumb policy platform that was all along.
That's your point, John. I think that the global economy requires more education than the manufacturing economy did.
It certainly does, and I think there's a important sort of rhetorical advantage there for teachers, you know, to capitalize on that and say that if you're going to say that education is so important for economic opportunity, then you need to pay us a decent wage and basically stop treating us as, you know, an extractive resource, which I think is really not an overstatement to say that's how teachers feel they've been treated in places like Oklahoma and West Virginia. But I think the bigger point is that, you know, the Democratic Party, the left in this country, has for too long basically crafted their entire notion, as Jennifer was saying, of economic opportunity around education. And that's not enough. I mean, clearly, that is not leading to more economic security for most Americans. And I think that the Democratic Party has made a huge mistake in embracing that and not taking more affirmative steps to ensure that all working people in this country have access to well-paying, good jobs. And that's what's going to need to happen in order to defeat the politics of Trumpism long-term.
Where are the Democrats, Jennifer? What would Hillary Clinton be doing as president here?
Well, it was interesting because one of the documents that came out in the WikiLeaks dump was this policy booklet where you got to see who the people were coming in the early days of her campaign trying to influence her on education.
Really?
And and you know, big wealthy people who ran the Broad Foundation and Laureen Powell Jobs, who's the head of the now owns the Atlantic and is the head of something called the Emerson Collective.
Oh, boy.
And you could see just one after another, you know, they were making the same case. New Orleans is great, right? Wouldn't it be great if we could have an all-charter model like they got to have in New Orleans after Katrina. And you could really, you sense that they thought that teachers were just such dimwits and that if you could just change the way that, you know, make it easier to get rid of the teachers that we have and bring in fancy, newer teachers, that was going to be the thing that put us on a platform. My concern...
Are we hearing echoes of Mark Zuckerberg in Newark, too?
We are, though it's not even an echo. It's just a straight-up repeat. My concern is that we're seeing all this great stuff on the ground. Maybe some politicians are starting to move. But the funders, the opinion page of the New York Times, the people who are writing the big checks, they're still all in for this narrow agenda and what John just described. Like, they really believe that the only political economy we need in this country is something that puts kids on a path to college.
Interesting. Can I just say, under the general heading of what the hell is going on here, I think you have to note that sort of Bernie Sanders' politics is still hugely under-respected. A certain style of plain talk about class interest and then getting out there and wearing out the shoe leather. Reality about class conflict and then militancy around basic Eisenhower-era social democratic values that we grew up with after World War II.
If I can jump in, I think that there's absolutely an underestimation of that. And, you look at Trump, for example, and sure, it was a very sort of garbled version of this, but, you know, you talk about the notion of draining the swamp, right? I think there's a sort of perverse element of Trumpism that you can find in Sanders' critique. And I think what many Americans are seeing now, middle-class America, that point about middle-class anxiety is so important. And they know who to blame for it, right? The people to blame are as Bernie Sanders said many times, the millionaires and billionaires. They're the ones who are stifling wide economic prosperity for everyone. And the Democratic Party has to take issue with that. And I don't think it's going to come from the top. I mean, to me, what's so exciting about these teachers is they're taking action, just like those students who are leading the walkouts. And those people need to vote, and those people need to run for office, and they need to get involved at their local Democratic, county parties, and basically take over those parties and make the Democratic Party into the progressive force it once was in the past.
So we should elect Jennifer Berkshire, in other words.
Yes.
That's a terrible idea.
Speak to the political opportunity here, Jennifer.
Well, I read John Shelton's fabulous book, Teacher Strike! ! And I can't recommend it enough to your listeners. But, he talks about the teacher strikes of the 60s and 70s. And those were really about, what kind of country we were going to have and how big the welfare state was going to be and what you could expect as a working class person. And frankly, they lost, right? That after that, they decided that
what happened?
Cities were too expensive to run and financiers needed a seat at the table and the vision of what's possible gets smaller and smaller. And now here we are 40 years later and the strikes are over austerity and that original vision shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. And even though we're talking about the difference between New York City and now Oklahoma, the debate is basically the same. What can we expect? And the definition of what we can expect has gotten whittled down to now it's basically to have the mail delivered and public education. And it's not a surprise that both are so vulnerable.
And maybe not the mail anymore.
Did she read your book right, John? But I wonder if we've heard the wake-up call about austerity, about cut as your system of government.
Boy, I think that's quite possible. I mean, I think this could be the beginning of a movement, but again, as a historian, it's contingency. I mean, things that happen in the past happen because hundreds, thousands, millions of people make decisions, and so again. Some of the early stuff I heard about West Virginia, it started in three counties. It was a cold day, and so they canceled school in a lot of other places, which led more teachers to demonstrate at the Capitol, and it just kind of gathered this momentum. And I think if teachers continue to win in these places, and students continue to walk out, and we continue to teach young people about democracy and the literal saying, this is what democracy looks like, then we might actually see a groundswell against not just austerity, but also the very low expectations that all we can do is facilitate private profit-making opportunities for corporations, right? And so I think that, there have been many democratic waves in U.S. history, in the 1930s, of course, and then in the 1960s. And something like that is very much possible, and this very much could be the tip of the iceberg. I hope that it is.
Let me ask you, Jennifer. Betsy DeVos is generally said to be the least popular member of the Trump cabinet, which is going some. Is her time up?
No, I mean, there were lots of rumors about that earlier this year. I think that she's having a great time and actually making quite a lot of headway, right? That when we talk, you played that little clip of the governor of Oklahoma, you know, raving about the idea of
DeVosism.
About education savings accounts. DeVos is the driving force behind a lot of that. You know, it's thanks to her that in the tax code now, you can get a hefty tax break by saving money to use towards private school tuition. She's making progress. I think what, you know, the missed opportunity here is that her lack of popularity is really, it really crosses party lines. And that a lot of those teachers will say that the parents supporting them, even though there's hardship, they often cite Betsy DeVos as their animating force.
It's always hard to read the Trump logic, but will we know, will he take note around Betsy DeVos of what's happening? I wonder.
Well, it depends if whether it's on Fox and Friends.
Thank you, Jennifer Berkshire and John Shelton. Thanks also to Steve Fraser, Dana Goldstein, Dana Kilacki, and the other teachers who spoke with us from Oklahoma. Our show this week was produced by Honor Roll Students All, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Homa Sarabi Dune, and Susan Coyne, the artist. Paul Kalo is our engineer. Mary McGrath is the headmistress of our school. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.